Rio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, residents at a Sullivan County mobile home park say they've endured years of unsafe water, sewage leaks, and illegal fees. Now the state is taking the owners to court for millions. What's at stake and what happens next? Isabel Braverman of the Sullivan County Democrat joins us with more. A proposed federal funding cut could shutter hundreds of Planned Parenthood clinics nationwide. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim speaks with local advocates about what's at stake for reproductive health care and marginalized communities. A new festival in Delhi drew cannabis enthusiasts and the canna curious alike. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Heiser takes us inside the Canna Bliss Festival in the Catskills. An adventure, mystery, romance, and a journey of self-discovery. Joan Glaze's debut novel has it all. We'll learn more after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. Stocks opened higher this morning as investors wait for today's interest rate announcement from the Federal Reserve. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 20 points in early trading.
The central bank is widely expected to hold interest rates steady this afternoon, but there could be some division among members of the rate-setting committee. Two Fed governors have signaled they'd be willing to cut rates today. President Trump's been calling for that. A rate cut is more likely at the next Fed meeting in September. The Commerce Department says the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 3% in April, May, and June, after shrinking during the first 3 months of the year. Most of the improvement reflects a drop in imports as the president's worldwide tariffs took effect. The economy in the Eurozone barely grew during the spring quarter, and the economy of Germany contracted. Trump plans to impose a tax of 15% on most imports from Europe starting Friday, August 1st. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. and China have ended their latest round of trade talks without a deal. News of that development has pushed Asian stocks into mixed territory for the day. The Shanghai Composite Index rose by 0.2%, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell 1.3%. Tokyo's Nikkei 225, meanwhile, fell less than 0.1%. Meanwhile, President Trump says tariffs on products coming into the U.S. from India will be 25%. Those tariffs take effect on August 1st. Trump made the announcement in a social media post. He also says India will be paying an extra amount because it buys much of its energy and military equipment from Russia. The administration has been saying for weeks that a trade deal with India was imminent. Fears of a tsunami hitting Hawaii and the western coast of the U.S. have subsided. A major earthquake hit near Russia's eastern coast overnight, sparking concerns. But even though parts of Hawaii may have seen waves as high as 4 feet, Governor Josh Green says all is well.
Thank you for being calm and being safe. So far, we have not seen a wave of consequence, which is great relief to us. It's kind of a blessing to not be reporting any damage.
The quake measured 8.8. It was one of the largest ever recorded. The Senate has narrowly voted to confirm President Trump's most controversial judge nominee, that despite three whistleblowers who came forward to raise doubts. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Senators voted 50-49 to advance Emil Bovey for a position on the Federal Appeals Court in Philadelphia, even after allegations from a Justice Department lawyer who raised questions about Bovey's candor and defiance of court orders on deportations. Bovey used to be President Trump's personal lawyer. He told senators he was not a henchman or an enforcer for the White House, but he's been at the center of several flashpoints inside the DOJ this year. Now he has a job on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That's a job he can keep for life. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Health officials in Gaza say at least 46 Palestinians have been killed there by Israeli gunfire since Tuesday night. The dead include more than 30 people who were killed while looking for food and other supplies. The Israeli military, meanwhile, has not commented on the latest deaths. The Trump administration wants to strip the Environmental Protection Agency of authority to regulate climate-warming greenhouse gases. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the proposal is likely to face legal challenges from environmental groups.
If the Trump administration proposal becomes final, regulations limiting climate pollution from power plants, cars and trucks, and the oil industry would be eliminated.
So this has been referred to as basically driving a dagger into the heart of the climate change religion.
EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin spoke on the conservative podcast podcast Ruthless. He argued previous administrations were mistaken when they thought the Clean Air Act authorized the agency to regulate climate pollution. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey criticized the proposal in front of EPA headquarters.
This is Massachusetts versus EPA all over again. We're ready to fight. We're knocked down. We're knocked down. We're not knocked out.
The EPA will collect public comments before issuing a final rule. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
3 days of hearings into the mid-air collision earlier this year in Washington, D.C. are underway today. The hearings will focus on the actions taken by the FAA, air traffic controllers, and the Army, and how those decisions may have contributed to the crash. 67 people died when an American Airlines jet and a Black Hawk helicopter collided near Reagan National Airport. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The owners of River Valley Estates, a manufactured home park in Loch Sheldrake, New York, are facing a sweeping lawsuit from New York Attorney General Letitia James. The state is seeking more than $2.5 million in restitution and penalties, alleging years of dangerous living conditions, contaminated water, sewage overflows, and illegal fees. The owners deny the allegations and say they've been making improvements. With a court decision expected later this summer, the case could have major implications for more than 200 residents. The Sullivan County Democrat has been reporting on this story, and Editor-in-Chief Isabel Braverman joins us live now with more. Good morning, Isabel.
Hi, good morning.
Can you start by summarizing the Attorney General's lawsuit against River Valley Estates and what's at stake?
Sure. So the lawsuit is stemming from years of what they say are...
Isabel, I'm going to just stop you real quick. If you're on a speakerphone, I'm going to ask you to pick up because it's hard to hear you over the air.
Oh. Hi, can you hear me better?
So much better. Thank you. So you're summarizing the Attorney General's lawsuit against River Valley Estates.
Yes. It's stemming from what they say are years of unsanitary living conditions. Starting back in 2018, the lawsuit alleges that there are issues with the water at the mobile home park, sewage overflows, unsafe roads, and illegal fees that residents have been facing when they have tried to pay their rent. So that lawsuit was filed in 2024, but it continues today.
And how is this lawsuit different from the one? How is this case different from the one back in 2018? It's not the first time, as you said, the state has gone to court against River Valley Estates.
Right. So, but back in 2018. That was dropped, that lawsuit, but the residents say that the issues are still continuing. So that's why another one was brought by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James.
The owners are pushing back, as we indicated. They say these claims are exaggerated and they've been making upgrades. What are they saying anything else? And does the state have any response to that? How strong is the state's case?
Right. So the owners are, you know, our reporter talked to the owners and they are quoted as saying that the people are looking for a buyout by bringing forth this lawsuit. They also say that they've been working with the Sullivan County Department of Public Health to fix these issues, including working on the water system and the sewage. But the residents are working with Assemblymember Paula Kay, and she says that, you know, this case will continue because the issues are still ongoing.
How are the residents coping right now with ongoing boil water orders and sewage problems? What are they saying?
Yeah, they're saying that, you know, they're being given little information, being told to basically fix the problems themselves. That's what one person said. And you know, so they've been living this for a few years, and they want to see it fixed.
And some of them have said that they're potentially facing retaliation for speaking up. What are they? What's that about? How widespread is that?
Yeah, that was one person who spoke. So there was recently a forum in Loch Sheldrake for the residents to come together and air their concerns. And one person did say that if they raise their concerns to the owners or the park management, that they're retaliated against. She said that it was, you know, when she brought her concerns, they responded in a racist manner. That's what she said has happened to her.
You mentioned Assemblymember Paula Kay. She hosted that forum. She acknowledged residents' frustration. What else did she say, and how did she provide reassurances to them?
Yeah, she said that they're working with the Attorney General of New York, and she rest assured that they will not only work with the Attorney General, but they also might have to work with private lawyer representation to continue to help the residents.
And Kay actually pledged to coordinate legal help by securing legal counsel through Legal Services of Hudson Valley?
Right, yes.
What's next? We mentioned that the decision is later this summer. What do we know about timeline and potential outcomes?
I'm really not sure. Yeah, okay. We'll have to see.
So it's just generally this summer, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then what else are folks saying to you, the Democrat, in terms of, you know, what this means to them? And, you know, just living there, one of the residents said, we want this fixed permanently.
Right. Yeah, I think that, they've been dealing with this since 2018, they've said. So I guess they're, you know, really hoping to see some change by working with not only the state, but, Assemblywoman Paula Kay, and hoping to move that forward.
And this is in the current issue of the Sullivan County Democrat, scdemocratonline.com. What else do you have in the current edition that you want folks to know about?
Yeah, we have a great issue out right now. We have a story about Sullivan County hosted a youth academy for emergency responders. So local teens got the chance to learn about EMS services in the county, everything from search and rescue to the LifeNet helicopter. So it's sort of, you know, creating the future of people who will be serving in these EMS capacities. So that's a really great story.
And it's all in the Sullivan County Democrat, scdemocratonline.com. Isabel Braverman, editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the new federal legislation that might impact Planned Parenthood. It could shutter hundreds of those clinics nationwide. Julia Kim speaks with local advocates about what's at stake. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got the return of hippie food. It's delicious this time, with cookbook author Jess Dammit. And we get mind-blowing, simple cooking tips from one of our favorite chefs, North Carolina's own Ashley Christensen. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
Writer Dori Shafrir always felt pressure to hit big life milestones on a particular timeline.
Like, write a book, maybe get married, buy an apartment. I mean, it was just like this list. And of course, by the time I turned 30, like, I had done none of these things.
Late Bloomers. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A sweeping new federal bill threatens to significantly limit access to reproductive health care across the country. One provision would block Planned Parenthood from receiving federal Medicaid funding for a year. That's a move that could force the closure of 200 clinics nationwide and disrupt care for millions of Americans. Although a federal judge has temporarily blocked the cuts from taking effect, the future remains uncertain. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with Planned Parenthood of Greater New York CEO Wendy Stark, Leslie Seary and Andrea Flynn of Rivertown for Reproductive Rights, and Sullivan County activist Dana Halperin about the potential impact on Planned Parenthood, the chronic underinvestment in women's and LGBTQ plus health care, and the disproportionate barriers marginalized communities already face. Here's Andrea Flynn.
Leslie, I remember flipping through the yellow pages to find Planned Parenthood in my community. And like, I took a car full of friends and we went there and we got, you know, like the birth control that we needed. And I think so much about like how empowering that was and how like, you know, it was nerve wracking. And then you went there and you felt cared for and you weren't judged and you got exactly what you needed and that you could afford. And the thought of like my daughter's generation not being able to do that is really devastating. Like I think about that moment in time so much. And it was really, you know, all of my friends and I who were like in the car that day talk about how it was like a really foundational experience for us.
Under Trump's big, beautiful bill, Planned Parenthood can lose federal Medicaid funding for 1 year, endangering 200 clinics nationwide that 1.1 million Americans currently depend on for health care. The provision targets not just Planned Parenthood, but all nonprofit clinics that provide abortions and received more than $800,000 in Medicaid payments in 2023, essentially restricting Medicaid users from using their insurance to cover services at any health care provider that fits this criteria. For Planned Parenthood, this risks the health care of half of their patients who rely on Medicaid as their insurance. Fortunately, a federal judge in Massachusetts has indefinitely blocked the provision from being enforced on Monday, July 28th, which follows Planned Parenthood having filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the cuts 3 weeks prior. The judge deemed the policy as retaliating against Planned Parenthood specifically in a way that violates their First Amendment rights, as little to no other nonprofit clinics in the country meet the $800,000 minimum except Planned Parenthood. New York currently has 48 Planned Parenthood locations that support 100,000 residents. In an interview with Radio Catskill, Planned Parenthood of Greater New York CEO Wendy Stark said the nonprofit will continue to maintain operation as they have been doing, with the goal of keeping as many of their doors open as possible as they look to the state to fill in that gap in funding. But Stark said hard decisions are likely ahead, whether that's laying off staff, reducing services, and even closing clinics at the detriment of people's access to essential sexual and reproductive health services like abortions. A, quote, backdoor abortion ban is how Stark referred to these cuts, which starve clinics across both red and blue states who perform abortions of their funding. Although federal Medicaid funding already cannot be used to cover abortions except in cases of rape, incest, or endangerment of their mother's life, these cuts threaten Planned Parenthood's other services, such as cancer screenings, STI testing, or pregnancy counseling, and their overall ability to be a healthcare provider for local communities.
We know that when the majority of people across the United States do not want there to be abortion bans, want people to have access to abortion services. And part of the way we know that is through ballot initiatives. And so ballot initiatives in states whose governments have been hostile or try to create or enforce abortion bans have seen that when the issue goes to the voters, people vote against, overwhelmingly vote against these kinds of bans. And so I think the strategy of trying to impact us monetarily in this way through public funds is a way of not having to try to pass a federal abortion ban because they know that the voters won't stand for that, right? And so trying to defund or economically injure, if you will, the providers of abortion care and specifically Planned Parenthood now, but I imagine this is only the first of other actions that the government may attempt, is trying to get rid of the providers of abortion, right? A different methodology of trying to keep people from essential healthcare services.
But Andrea Flynn said what is especially concerning is that these cuts to Planned Parenthood are not isolated. Flynn is a professor at Columbia University who specializes in researching the economics of reproductive health, as well as a resident of Westchester County, where she's active in the grassroots group Rivertown for Reproductive Rights. From cuts to Medicaid that stand to leave almost 12 million Americans uninsured by 2034, which in turn defunds community hospitals and clinics, to cuts to research on women and queer people's healthcare, Flynn compared these cuts to an onion that keeps unfolding, disproportionately hurting working-class women and our women of color in the process.
So we have the Medicaid cuts, attacks on Planned Parenthood, and then there are also all sorts of other ways this is going to impact the community, right? We have small hospitals that are already on the brink of closure, will not be able to sustain themselves without Medicaid. These hospitals are already running on razor-thin margins. They provide like critical care to those in the greatest need. They are really like community safety net hospitals. They're already on the brink of closure. And in many communities, these are the only places where people can go for care, right? You're pregnant and you need an emergency care. This is the hospital you go to. If that hospital closes, you might have to travel an hour or 2 hours for care. And I think we can all imagine what sort of the dire impact of that is on someone who needs any kind of emergency care.
These Medicaid cuts come as Planned Parenthood has already been financially struggling due to a historical issue of under-reimbursement for women and queer people's healthcare across administrations, Stark said. In fiscal year 2024, Stark said it cost $67 million for Planned Parenthood of Greater New York to provide healthcare services, but was only reimbursed $36 million by different insurance plans, including Medicaid.
So we have already had to make a series of hard decisions over the last years that were partly the result of the COVID pandemic and all of the challenges to healthcare infrastructure that happened in that pandemic, to the incredible inflation that we've seen since the pandemic, especially in the healthcare realm, and to really long-standing problem that many outpatient healthcare services, and specifically primary care services, and specifically sexual and reproductive health services, and especially for people who are assigned female at birth, are so under-reimbursed, right? And so the level of reimbursement does not equate to what it actually costs to provide these services. And that is a structural problem in our healthcare system writ large, and really speaks to the undervaluing of sexual and reproductive healthcare services and the bodies of people assigned female at birth and trans folks writ large.
Leslie Seary, who founded Rivertown for Reproductive Rights after Roe v. Wade was overturned to help fundraise for the New York Abortion Access Fund, expressed that the effect of these cuts on a healthcare system that's never been easy to navigate for women is daunting to think about for her and her three daughters.
All it takes is one complication with your health, and then you realize how much time and effort it takes to advocate for yourself. I'm fine, but like I recently had a lump in my breast and had to go get it checked out. And the amount of time I spent trying to find a place that could get me in for a diagnostic mammogram in like a timely manner. Also, even before that, just getting into my OBGYN or my general practitioner, it was unbelievable. And I was thinking about these things. And if I had a full-time job, or I had a newborn baby at home, or all these different things, luckily I was able just to sit there and like call all sorts of different places. And also the advice was look further north in the more affluent areas. Like, don't go south towards the city where like I usually go. So I was driving up to, you know, areas that were less densely populated, but still very, very affluent. And that's how I was able to sort of sneak in and get seen. But it was just, it made me feel really upset because I was in a scary situation and I needed answers. And it was so hard for me coming from such a place of privilege. So then you just see it. And I was talking to my mom about it and stuff. And my mom's dealing with some health stuff as well that, you know, it's just complicated in appointments. And I'm like, you just have to keep calling and you have to like get yourself in there. She said, I was talking about maybe Medicaid or something. And, you know, well, what are these people going to do that don't have insurance? And I'm like, Mom, they don't even go to the doctor. they just die. Like, they don't know they have cancer. Like, I think that's what we could ultimately lose or already are losing. And these are the voices we're also not hearing because they've already been silent. They don't have the bandwidth to speak out. They're just kind of surviving and getting by.
As clinics close due to lack of funding, healthcare will become that much harder for the communities who've been facing barriers, especially New York's rural communities where limited healthcare providers and transportation costs have acted as major roadblocks to care. Dana Halperin, a chef and activist native to Sullivan County, said it's hard to think about the impact of these new cuts when the county had already lost its only Planned Parenthood back in 2020. What had started out as a temporary closure due to financial issues became permanent, forcing residents who wanted to continue using Planned Parenthood to have to travel up to over an hour to other counties. In many cases, Halperin said, it has led people to forgo care altogether.
So we worked our way up and we met eventually with the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater New York. And it became very apparent that that was a permanent closure in Monticello and they had no plans of reopening a clinic in Sullivan County and that they couldn't maintain the clinics that they did have open. At the time when we first started meeting with them in 2024, the closest Planned Parenthood location outside of Sullivan County was the Goshen office. And so we were asking for alternatives to care. If you're not going to reopen a Planned Parenthood in Sullivan County, can you provide transportation? Can you provide what other resources can be provided besides the physical location? Towards the end, the middle of 2024, with these ongoing meeting series, and they were suggesting the Goshen and the Newburgh locations as the alternative to the Monticello location, the Goshen location closed in August of 2024, as well as a few other upstate New York locations. So this has been a trend for Planned Parenthood of Greater New York to be closing these more rural health clinics and consolidating services elsewhere. You know, we're spending so much time talking about, well, Trump did this and he's passing this bill that's going to take away your health care. Well, folks were losing their health care under the previous administration as well. Both Planned Parenthood locations closed, both the Monticello and the Goshen office closed when there was a Democrat in office. In office at the federal level, and we had a person in office at our state level as well who was voting on the New York fiscal budget of 2024 that did not provide enough of the Medicaid reimbursement rate to keep these facilities operating.
Sullivan County in particular is among the lowest in state health rankings, and about 35% of its residents rely on Medicaid. The county is also home to a large population of migrant workers for whom options are narrower and healthcare access has proven to be an even bigger challenge, Halperin said. While the county does have other healthcare providers besides Planned Parenthood, Halperin, who is a Medicaid recipient themselves, explained that some have long wait times of up to a couple of months for appointments, while other hospitals don't even take Medicaid or have OBGYN services.
One thing we're not really mentioning right now in this conversation is that a large portion of folks living in Sullivan County are migrant workers. They're immigrants here. They may be undocumented, so they may have additional barriers to receiving a driver's license, receiving health care. I know that there are certain clinics like Sun River who really make sure that they're serving that population. But as we see more and more cuts to Medicaid, that although that individual person might not be a Medicaid recipient, the facility like Sun River and our local hospital gets Medicaid dollars to treat people who are under or not insured. So that those continued cuts to those systems are going to create a whole population of people in Sullivan County who cannot receive health care, like, period.
And once these clinics are lost, Flynn said they will not be easy to rebuild, meaning communities, especially those already under-resourced, will be deprived of essential services beyond just the 4 years that Trump is in office.
I think we just need to remember that, like, women aren't the only people who go to these healthcare clinics. It's family care. It's not just women's healthcare. We know that healthy moms mean healthier families, but these are also places where teens go, where LGBTQ young people feel safe accessing care. They are really community providers. And so I just, when I think about the like pretty immediate and short-term impact, and never mind the long-term impact, it feels like a pretty seismic shift that we're about to see. And we're really talking about like kind, compassionate, like culturally appropriate, sensitive care. Not everyone wants to go to a hospital to have their like most intimate needs met. It's been proven time and time again that these clinics are incredibly safe, super effective, and that a whole bunch of people who use them rely on them as their like only trusted source of care. And I think particularly in a moment where our rights and access to healthcare are being attacked at every turn, having a place you go where you feel safe, where you feel like you can trust the providers is just incredibly important. So I want us to think about like not just losing that access to care, but it is like losing a pillar of a community that allows you to feel safe and cared for.
I just spoke with Planned Parenthood of Greater New York CEO Wendy Stark, Leslie Seary, and Andrea Flynn of Rivertown for Reproductive Rights, and Sullivan County activist Dana Halperin on these federal cuts to Planned Parenthood and how they will exacerbate existing barriers to healthcare. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar takes us inside Cannabliss, the festival in the Catskills. That's next. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Latif Nasser from Radiolab. Public media organizations across the country lost our federal funding. This cut will have long-term consequences for the service we provide to you, our community, unless we are able to replace that funding with support from more of our listeners. The future of public media is in your hands. Go to this station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A new festival in Delhi, New York, engaged the Canna Curious and Canna Sur this past weekend. Canna Bliss in the Catskills brought together hundreds of attendees to celebrate upstate New York's growing cannabis community. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar visited the first day of Cannabliss in the Catskills and chatted with cannabis farmers, business owners, and attendees about the future of cannabis 4 years after New York State legalized recreational marijuana. She brings us this report from Delaware County.
A different shade of green has hit the Catskills' mountainous terrain, cannabis. Last weekend, a new festival called Cannabliss in the Catskills held its first ever event in Delhi, New York at Maple Shade Farm. One attendee, Jill, played Jenga in the farm's 200-acre field, where she said it was nice to be at an event where she didn't feel judged for enjoying cannabis.
Tell me a little bit about how the day has been for you guys.
Oh, it's been a blast. It's been a blast. I've been getting high and talking to all these great people, and I've just been having, we've been having the best of time.
Maple Shade Farm is a 200-acre farm typically used for weddings and music festivals. But event organizer Joanne Kudrevich of Ravensview Genetics says the owners wanted to do something different this year.
So these are our neighbors, and they had approached me because they do huge festivals. They'd approached me to see if we could do something with cannabis. And so we brought the weed to the farm, basically.
Folks from across New York State and even out of state turned out for the weekend's festivities. There were musicians, growers, and lovers of the hemp plant present. Kudrevich says growing cannabis is a passion she hadn't always been interested in.
How did you become a cannabis cultivator yourself?
This is my husband's passion. I come from healthcare, corporate healthcare, building very large corporate healthcare practices. And he's a cannabis enthusiast and has been cultivating and gathering genetics for very many years. for him, this is his passion is about the genetics. It's about making sure we maintain the integrity of the original plants, the original seeds that are from landrace and heirloom origin. So the purity of the plant. Coming from healthcare and owning a holistic health practice and being a nurse, for me, the integrity of the whole plant is important because then you have the plant medicine intact. And so when he said he wanted to do this and New York State legalized, I came in to support that.
New York State legalized recreational cannabis in 2021 through the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. The law made it legal for adults 21 and older to carry and consume up to 3 ounces of weed. Many advocates celebrated the law as a tool that would reduce cannabis arrests, which disproportionately affect people of color. But establishing a business in a newly regulated industry has been challenging, says Kudrevich.
Oh gosh, there have been so many challenges. So we, as well as probably 370 others like us, were the first to get licensed as cultivators in New York State under a provisional license program that gave us 2 years. Of course, that would normally be the first to give you the first to market advantage. But unfortunately, it worked opposite in the sense that New York State hadn't really been able to roll the whole legalization process out very well. A lot of folks sued the state. And as a result, there were no dispensaries open for 2 whole years. So all of us grew a lot of product. We alone grew 2,000 pounds of smokable flower in 2 years with no place to sell it. So for those of us who got in early, we accumulated quite a bit of debt.
New York State has been slow to build the infrastructure for the industry, but it has made some progress since legalization, according to growers.
And now in 2023, we were able to mount the cannabis grower showcases, which gave us opportunity for events like this where we could speak directly to the consumer and do some minimal sales. 24 is when the market started to open with dispensaries, and that's really been the first. So those who are getting into the market now have the advantage, truly, because the market is somewhat set up. I mean, day to day, week to week, it's changing, and there's new things, new regulations and stuff that are coming on board as we speak. So we're having to zig and zag and get flexible and you know, all of the things. But this is, you know, we're at the forefront of building an industry that will be the greatest in New York State, in the world, probably.
The 2-day event brought in a diverse group of about a dozen vendors from across the state, some who grew cannabis, but many who just loved cannabis culture. From organic farm Sam Ludwig of Astor Farms.
We are the largest cultivation in Delaware County, and we grow outdoor cannabis, all in-ground live soil, all organic.
To Jocelyn Miner of JBM Jewelry.
I make bracelets and necklaces out of crystals and stones. And my slogan is, get stoned. If you're not already stoned, I can get you stoned.
There were even workshops about the plant. Inside a large barn, SUNY Delhi adjunct instructor Diana Dixon is gathered around a table teaching her course called What Your Bud Tender Won't Tell You, But Should. Here, she's talking about the science and risks of mixing cannabis with other products like caffeine.
The challenge is that these herbs, guess what, have their own picture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They have their own actions. They have their own effects.
Yeah.
So if you don't even know they're in there, then that's an issue. All right? And I'll give you a prime example. But caffeine and melatonin are my hugest concerns. Mm. All right? So I actually put it when I'm doing the inventory product list on our menu, I put plus melatonin or plus caffeine because there are people who are sensitive to those two things and they're not expecting that.
Do you do the same with like other organics like, I don't know, lion's mane or other mushrooms?
Right, adaptogens, nootropics.
Right.
That is harder to get in a line item on a menu. Mm. I'm most concerned about melatonin, but you're damn right I'm going to talk to people about it.
Consuming the plant responsibly is essential to enjoying it, says Kudrevich. Cannabis-related ER visits in New York jumped nearly 57% in the years marijuana was legalized compared to pre-legalization years, according to state data. Kudrevich says safety starts with educating the consumer.
In our belief, an educated consumer will drive the quality at the dispensary. And that's what we want. We want people to know that they're buying New York State flower and not something that came in illegally from another state. We want them to know the difference between a legal cannabis dispensary and an illegal one. So just continuing to do things like this and getting the word out is really the most critical part.
Like, how do you, as a cannabis business owner, balance that education and the importance of safety for consumers?
Well, truly, having a legal market where everything is tested in a lab that's New York State licensed is the way that we maintain safety health and safety. So educating, again, the consumer about why go this way. You know, the regulations around what we're being tested for and what the criteria is clearly is so much above and beyond what anybody was buying on the street and still is, right? So, but the idea that if we want to maintain something that's safe, then that's the way to do it.
For attendees Jill and Tyler, they said having an event on a beautiful farm like Maple Shade Farm helps destigmatize the plant.
It's amazing that we can have like an event where we can just like openly consume and not be judged by anyone. No one's giving me a dirty look, and I've been like, yes, I love it.
What are you most excited about for as you think about like the future of the cannabis industry?
I'm most excited for how it gives back to New Yorkers and how we get to like benefit our lives from the effects of all the products that are, these amazing products that are coming out.
And there's just so many new ones coming out. I can't wait to see the different brands coming out, the new technology, the new ways to consume and the types. Like it's adapting every single day, and it's just been amazing. This whole journey has been amazing.
And the future of the industry is evolving. One of the vendors was Anne Forcuzza from BioTrack. They're the seed-to-sale software company that New York State contracted with to track marijuana sales. Forcuzza says the Cannabis event says a lot about how far the industry has come.
I've been in the cannabis tech industry for almost 10 years. I've gone to a lot of events, and most of the time these cannabis events, they're in like the basement of a conference room with fluorescent lighting and beige carpet. They're in like the outside of the parking lot in an alley, like under a tent and stuff. So, you know, and then, you know, you need to start somewhere, not just in that, like there's a time and place for that too. But I think just being in such like a mainstream location, it introduces a lot of folks who maybe are more curious about cannabis and would never normally go to a cannabis show, that they would come to this venue and explore more about it.
As more dispensaries are expected to open up by the end of this year, Kudrevich says events like Cannabis will be even more important for connection and community.
And that's what cannabis is about, right? It's about all people coming together, sharing some product and having a good time, music, food. And since it became more, let's say, a competitive market, we've all splintered and gotten busy into our own silos. So things like this offer us the opportunity to come together with others like us and really share in something that's communal and that feels good.
In Delhi, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thanks to our own Kimberly Izar for that report. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have culture reporter Valerie Manzi's conversation with author Joan Glaze. Her debut novel, Searching for John Smith, has it all: adventure, mystery, romance, and a journey of self-discovery. That's next after a quick break. This is Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab.
This story is kind of like a bad joke where it's like a protein, a cell, and a funny little molecule walk into the thymus.
I don't even know what the thymus is.
We'll go to a place in the body that's
remarkable, wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also,
makes us know who we are.
What?
Yes.
It is crazy.
That's on the next Radiolab.
It's so existential.
This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the exotic sounds of the Bahama Soul Club and the Left Arm of Buddha, plus the unreleased Les Baxter. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Come join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Coming up tonight at 7.
on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Local author Joan Glaze is stepping into the literary spotlight with her debut novel, Searching for John Smith. The book weaves together adventure, mystery, romance, and unexpected twists as readers follow Julia, a heroine, on a journey of resilience and self-discovery that forces her to confront a painful past. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Joan Glaze ahead of her reading and discussion at the Cutting Garden Domesticities in Youngsville on Sunday.
Good morning, Radio Chatskill listeners. Today I have right here in our studio in Liberty, Joan Glaze. Joan Glaze is here to tell us about her debut novel. Now, Joan was born and raised in Ohio. She then went to San Francisco and did photography, got to New York City, did fashion photography, where she met her husband, Rocky, and they moved right up here into the Catskills back in 2003 with their son. And while she's been up here, she's done public relations, and then somehow or other decided to write a book. So that's what we're going to find out about. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And it's so exciting that you have a debut novel out.
It's very exciting for me, too. It's been quite a project, and I'm very pleased with it.
And tell us the name.
It's called Searching for John Smith.
Okay. And I have to admit, I haven't read all of it. So, but I did read the beginning.
Okay.
And so I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
The quote, "Let no man despise the secret hints and notices of danger, which may sometimes be given him, when he may think there is no possibility of its being real." Daniel Defoe, Robinson Crusoe.
Correct.
And I thought that was interesting because I read the prologue, and mm-hmm. the prologue has a hint of the past is prologue. And she also is reading Robinson Crusoe.
Correct.
When she goes away.
Right.
So I guess I'm going to be beginning with that question I have, Robinson Crusoe.
Why?
Yes.
Because that book is pretty much about being alone and then coming across circumstances of danger and friendship. And that's exactly what she's doing. She's going on vacation alone. And she also has a little bit of a history of maybe seeing things, a little hallucinations here and there, mostly of her dead mother. And then a few other little things here and there during life. And she tries to keep it quiet, but somehow people in her town know about it and they keep bringing it up. But that's a very minor part of the story.
So what is the story?
Well, the story is the main character, Julia, who is, like I said, going on vacation alone in the Baja, and it takes place in the 1970s. She's going alone, which is kind of uncommon then for women to travel alone, but she goes to the Baja and she finds it to be desolate. There's cars abandoned along the side of the highway that have been stripped. She gets to her hotel and she's the only guest there. She has dinner in the dining room and she is alone. And she's a little freaked out about this. She feels like her travel agent tricked her. But she ends up meeting the only other guest in the hotel, coincidentally, who happens to be a handsome, charming, charismatic man named John Smith, who used to be a drug dealer, and now he is there buying gems. He's like a small-time gem dealer. He buys opals and silver jewelry and travels back and forth. He's a private pilot, so he flies from Santa Cruz area. And of course, they hit it off and have a wonderful relationship and a romance, and she realizes this is the best thing that's ever happened to her since her parents were killed when she was six, and she's finally found joy in her life. And just when everything's going great, what happens is they're driving on this highway and they run out of gas, which again freaks her out because that's how her parents died. And this is purely panic for her.
Yeah. So this is the beginning.
of?
The very beginning is the story of how her parents ran out of gas when she was 6 years old.
Which was very beautifully and powerfully written.
Oh, thank you.
It was, I really felt the fear of that child.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that story is told as a prologue, and then it's interspersed throughout the book here and there. So you understand the details and what happened and how she lost her parents.
What made you decide on this particular subject and era?
Well, truthfully, I went to the Baja in the 70s.
Okay.
And I came across the desolate roads, the empty hotels, and the cars abandoned along the side of the road. And so the story kind of started brewing then, and then I dropped it. And it kept coming back once in a while. And I started writing it probably in the late 90s when I finally got a personal computer so I could actually write it. And then, of course, I had a child and I got busy and work and all that. And so I picked it up again not so long ago, right after I retired from Sullivan Arc or the Arc Greater Hudson Valley. And then because it had been brewing in my head for so long, I was able to write it very quickly. So again, I would change things, edit things, and it took me probably a good 2 years to really finalize it. And then, of course, it came time to publish.
But you did it, and yes. You self-published.
I self-published because I really didn't have any other choices. In order to publish a book, you need a literary agent. And that's like probably the most impossible thing to do. I queried several literary agents, and I probably heard back from maybe half of them. A lot of them just never heard back. Most of them say, you'll hear back from us in 6 to 8 weeks. And after that, if you don't hear from us, then we're not interested. So I heard from a few out of the maybe 30 that I queried, and they're all kind of said the same form letter. Oh, it's not really the type of story that we're interested in. So I turned to Amazon, who is very generous with their publishing ability or abilities, giving people the ability to self-publish. So that really was kind of easy, truthfully. I mean, I had to lay it out and do the cover. You can hire people to do the cover, but I did the cover myself. And that was kind of the easy part.
So would you like to read something from your debut novel to us?
Yes, I would love to. So this is a section. I told you a little bit about the hallucinations. So she's in the room with the man. His name is John Smith, but he's trying to go by his middle name now, which is Vincent. Cocaine was everywhere those days, but it was very expensive, so I'd only tried it a few times when people offered it to me. All it did was numb my mouth and nose and make me feel edgy. I couldn't understand why it was so popular because it did nothing for me. I've tried coke, no big deal for me. As far as acid, no, thank you. I've had enough hallucinations on my own. As soon as I said it, I wished I hadn't. Oh, yeah? What kind of hallucinations? Vincent was clearly interested. Oh, nothing. Forget I even said it. I began searching my brain for something to change the subject with. Vincent reached over and began tickling me. Come on, tell me, what kind of hallucinations? I gave in and told him about the man in my neighbor's yard and the guy on the stage with the band at the high school dance. I even told him a little bit about seeing my mom here and there. But I didn't tell him how much I looked for her or counted on her having visions of her when I was scared or anxious. He didn't react like I was crazy, but rather seemed like it was no big deal. I was relieved. You were probably just tired. I didn't tell him about the shadowy figure in my room that first night, even though at this point I was convinced it was just another hallucination. Just then there was a lot of noise coming from outside. We could hear people's voices and car doors slamming. I got up and peeked out the shutters. It looks like some Mexican movie stars are here, I said with a little sarcasm. Oh, blank. Vincent pumped up like he had just been stung by a bee. He sounded alarmed and nervous. What's the matter? I asked. Parked out in front were two Jeeps. They looked like they were armored. There were two men standing there talking to Jose, pointing and looking around the hotel grounds. They looked Mexican and both were extraordinarily handsome and well-groomed. One had longish black hair and was wearing an all-white suit with a black shirt under the jacket that was unbuttoned halfway to his navel, sporting several gold chains draping his chest. The other had shorter black slicked back hair wearing black dress pants and a short-sleeved gold metallic dress shirt. They looked obviously wealthy compared to most Mexican citizens I had encountered. A woman who was very dark and exotically beautiful got out of one of the jeeps. She was dressed in a low-cut white leather vest and matching short, tight skirt. She was wearing white high heels and a white straw hat. Her long brown hair was straight and shiny. I felt like I was looking at three movie stars. "Who are those people?" I asked Vincent, who was now peeping through the shutters. "The Velasquez brothers. They're the owners of the hotel. The woman is the wife of one of them. She wants to tear down the hotel so she can have a house built here. She says it's the most beautiful piece of property around, and she likes the pool. She has utter control of her husband. Poor Jose, no wonder he's been so distracted lately. He's been trying to prove to them that the hotel is a good investment." Suddenly, a short, stocky man walked around from the other side of one of the jeeps. My heart nearly stopped. He was in a military uniform with the same shape as the shadowy figure I'd seen in my room that first night. He was holding a rifle strapped across his chest. "Who's that soldier?" I asked, trying to sound calm, although I could feel my palms sweating. "Oh, that's Hector. He's one of the private bodyguards. He's also a local cop, which is the military in Estivo." Vincent knew an awful lot of people. I was just about to ask him why they needed a bodyguard when Vincent began barking orders at me. "Here's what I want you to do. Get dressed and walk to my room. It's unlocked. I'll sneak you out the back door. Then you open my back door and let me in." "What's going on, Vincent?" "I'll explain in a minute. Just hurry."
Okay, so we're left with a little bit of a cliffhanger there.
I hope so.
Yes. So this book has a lot of emotion and some romance and certainly some adventure.
Yes, there's a lot of romance.
Oh, good.
I didn't read the romance part.
Okay.
But there's some mystery, suspense, and some scary parts, too.
And where can our listeners get the book?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com.
Good.
You just search in the book section of Amazon, searching for John Smith or my name, Joan Glace.
And you'll be doing a book reading this Sunday, August 3rd?
Correct.
At the Cutting Garden Domesticities.
Correct.
In Youngsville, and that's at
2 o'clock.
2 to 4.
Yes.
So folks can get to meet you.
Yes.
And ask questions.
Yes. I'll do a few more readings and then
buy a book.
And the books will be there for sale, and I'm going to sell them at a discount, cheaper than you can get them on Amazon. So hopefully that's an incentive. And you can also, if you're like a Kindle reader, you can buy them from me too. I just give you a link and you can get the Kindle book.
Well, thank you. I am a Kindle reader, so I'm going to do that. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing this with us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to local author Joan Glace. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a reminder that since we've been defunded by Congress, we need your input more than ever. We want you to turn up the feedback and take our community survey. Tell us what's working, what you think needs improvement as we move forward. We'll need your input to make some important decisions. Just go to WJFFradio.org, click on the little icon on the right with the colorful headphones, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a chance to win prizes from Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, Hemlock Never Sink Spa, One Grand Books, and Shadowland Stages. Again, take our community survey, give us your feedback, go to WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming. Also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we'll rebroadcast a 2016 conversation with Bruce Springsteen. The legendary rock star spent 7 years on his autobiography, covering everything from his childhood and early days performing to his international success and the ambivalence he felt about it. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. That heat advisory is in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. These hot temperatures and high humidity could cause heat illnesses. Be sure to drink plenty of fluids, stay in air-conditioned room, or stay out of the sun, and check up on relatives and neighbors. And if you have pets, please be sure that they have ready access to shade and extra water. The high today officially is going to be around 87, already 84 at our Liberty Studios, but feels like 88. Cloudy tonight, low near 65. Showers early tomorrow, becoming steady rain later in the day with a high of only 71. Rainfall near half an inch is possible. It's 11 o'clock.